I'll be taking over through Joshua 6 through 8. And so, for a little context, as we know, Israelites, they've just crossed the Jordan, and they're going over to Jericho. And so, we learn about the fall of Jericho, and leading up to the fall of Jericho. So, in chapter 6, verse 1, I'll just start reading. Now the gates of Jericho were securely barred because of the Israelites, and no one went out and no one came in. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have delivered Jericho into your hands, along with its king and its fighting men. March around the city once with all the armed men. Do this for 6 days. Have 7 priests carry trumpets of ram's horns in front of the ark. On the 7th day, march around the city 7 times with the priests blowing the trumpets. When you hear them sound a long blast on the trumpets, have the whole army give a loud shout, then the wall of the city will collapse and their army will go up, every one straight in." All right. So in the first couple verses, we see the Lord makes a proclamation. What is this proclamation that we see? Very easy. Very simple. Jericho is given into your hands. So he makes this proclamation that Jericho is already given into their hands. And he says this as though it's already happened, as though it's past tense. And he's going to do this a couple of times. And so this is showing that God's promises, we don't need to question or be without confidence in God's promises. And he later on describes this plan. And we're going to be talking about, plans throughout this as well. There's a couple plans, but this one is one that the Lord gives them, right? So he goes forward, he says, go march around the city for 6 days, right? And then on the 7th day, march around 7 times, and then blow the trumpet. And then blow the trumpet, and when you hear the trumpet, make a loud cry and the walls will fall, right? And so here, and I actually skipped a point. So in this early part, we see that God is making them do seemingly an arbitrary task. This arbitrary task is walking around the perimeter of the wall. First, what are some other examples that we might have seen throughout the Bible? Doesn't just have to be before this, but also after this, where God makes his people do seemingly arbitrary tasks in order to gain a blessing. What are some examples or some things that we can think of? Making his people do seemingly arbitrary tasks in order to receive a blessing. And so one of the reasons why that God does this is so that it's not just, essentially it's not just a handout, right? We are more involved in the blessing that's being given to us, and it's a display of faith, right? All these things are essentially God saying, look, there's a blessing for you to receive here. There's something for you to receive here, and I'm with you, but you need to put your faith in me, you need to trust me, and you need to do what I ask you to do, even if it's a smaller task, right? It's an example, perfect example with Naaman. Naaman almost didn't do it, and then his servant had to call him out and say, look, this is the easiest thing ever. Just go dip yourself in the water 7 times. And then he does it, and guess what? He's healed. And so we see in these examples that, you know, even though these are seemingly arbitrary tasks, and once again, like you said, baptism, you know, something that is just simple, the spiritual depth and the spiritual meanings behind it are something that we can fully comprehend, but we know that it is something that God wants us to do and that God has ordered us to do. And so showing a little faith in doing it and allowing that to be what connects us to him and allows us to trust him in this direct way, and that allows us to participate in our salvation in a way, helps create this bond between us and him. Does anybody have any thoughts or ideas on that going off of that?
One observation is that, you know, it's one thing to do something that doesn't take very much time and then get immediate blessing from it. Many examples is another thing is the some of the promises, like live a righteous life and do the right things for a long period of time and keep praying and pray for your enemies and love one another. Even when things are hard, and it seems like it's forever, you know. And some people might, or I might, is this going to happen? You know, mm-hmm. You know, it's to keep your faith, in other words, to go a long period of time, year to year. So the one thing that helps is to read about the short period of time. And we were asked to do mundane things, and the blessings came, the promises were doubled. So it's just, so I need to keep reading.
Yeah, so just not just keeping faith in the short term, but also the long term. And notice in both of those ways, God is still the one doing the works, right? And in both of those examples, like you said, maintaining the faith is what's key to that. So yeah, good. Anybody else before we move on? Right, cool. So, moving forward. So, verse 6, so Joshua, son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and have 7 priests carry trumpets in front of it. And he ordered the army, advance, march around the city with an armed guard going ahead of the Ark of the Lord. When Joshua had spoken to the people, 7 priests carrying the 7 trumpets before the Lord went forward, blowing the trumpets, and the Ark of the Lord's Covenant followed them. The armed guard marched ahead of the priests and blew the trumpets, and the rear guard followed the ark. All this time the trumpets were sounding, but Joshua had commanded the army, do not give a war cry, do not raise your voice, do not say a word until I tell you to shout, and then shout. So he had the Ark of the Lord carried around the city, circling it once, and then the army returned to the camp and spent the night there. Okay, so notice, I just wanted real quick, and this isn't really that big, but notice how fervent Joshua is on obeying the exact commands of the Lord, and that the other Israelites should follow suit. He's not taking, you know, the Lord's commands lightly in this situation. He has an attitude of, I'm going to follow this to the T, and I'm going to do exactly what the Lord has instructed me to do, because that is the only way I can, you know, receive this blessing that he's going to give me, right, or give us. And so he has all the part Israel follow suit and fall in line. I think that in order for us to continue to maintain our blessings and continue to maintain our community, we should have this type of attitude of not just following the Lord on our own, but also trying to set an example and to lead others to follow the words of the Lord and what he says. And so I think this is just a really good example in Joshua's attitude and showing that he's willing to continuously listen and not just listen once. Does anybody have any other thoughts or ideas before we move forward? Cool, yeah. All right. So, and then going on, verses 12 and on, we see Joshua gets up early the next morning. He takes up the ark and 7 priests carrying the trumpet, and they went forward marching before the ark of the Lord. And then they blew the trumpets. The armed men went ahead of them, and the rear guard followed the ark of the Lord while the trumpets kept sounding. So the second day, they marched around the city, and they did this for 6 days. So on the seventh day, it's the final day, they got up at daybreak, they marched around the city 7 times in the same manner, except on that day they circled the city 7 times. The seventh time around, when the priest sounded the trumpet, and Joshua commanded the army, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. City and all that is in it are to be devoted to the Lord. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in the house shall be spared, because she hid the spies we sent. But keep away from the devoted things, so that you will not bring about your own destruction by taking any of them. Otherwise, you will make the camp of Israel liable to destruction and bring trouble on it. All the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron, are sacred to the Lord and must go into his treasury." Okay, so we see that there are a couple things here, right? We see that in verse 16, Joshua makes this proclamation. He says, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city." It's kind of going off this idea we talked about earlier, where Joshua is acting as though this event has already happened. Even though the walls still haven't come down, even though all their army is still in there ready to fight, he's basically making this proclamation as though it's already happened, which is essentially what he believes. In order for his, this shows that his faith and his trust in the Lord is absolute in this moment, right? And I think this is a good example for us to, you know, look at. And going forward, we also see that he says to spare Rahab. Now, if anybody remembers Rahab from the past chapters, Rahab was a Gentile prostitute who hid some of the spies, and she basically, for some reason, she had fear for the Lord, and hid the spies and away from her own people, and basically put herself in danger for the sake of the Israelites. And so he tells them, spare just their family. Destroy everything except for them, right? And so I wanted to bring that point up because, well, actually, let me open this up to you guys. Why do you think it's very important that he makes this distinction between Rahab and the others in there? David?
Well, I mean, the fear of the Lord is a sign of faith. And we know that whether we're in the Old Testament time or the Testament time, it's faith in God that saves.
And so, her faith is basically what saved her. And not only that, but there was a promise made to keep her safe. And so, not fulfilling that promise would essentially be like a sin against God. But going off of your idea, yes, she showed her faith, and that is what saved her in this situation. And I think it's also amazing that she's a Gentile in this situation, right? Where the Israelites were told to go into the land and bring out all the people, but this Gentile woman is spared and saved and is allowed to, later on we see, come into the fold of the people. And so I think that's very significant and actually alludes to some things we see going forward. Before we move on, does anybody have anything else to add to that last section before we move on? Cool.
Yeah, just to add, and it's just a good reminder that, while the Israelites were God's chosen people, it's just another example that shows that, God cared for the nations, the Gentiles as well.
Very good. All right. And so, verse 20, when the trumpet sounded, the army shouted and the sound of the trumpet. When the men gave a loud shout, the wall collapsed, so everyone charged straight in, and they took the city. They devoted the city to the Lord and destroyed with the sword everything living in it, men, women, young and old, cattle, sheep, and donkeys. Joshua said to the two men who had spied out in the land, "Go to the prostitute's house and bring her out and all who belong to her in accordance with your oath to her." So the young men who had done the spying went in and brought out Rahab, her father, her mother, her brothers, and her sisters, and all who belonged to her. They brought out her entire family and put them in a place outside the camp of Israel. And then going on, Then they burned the whole city and everything in it, but they put the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron into the treasury of the Lord. But Joshua spared Rahab the prostitute with her family and all who belonged to her, because she hid the men Joshua had sent as spies to Jericho, and she lives among the Israelites to this day. And so I wanted to stop and talk about Rahab really quick, and the connection I see with her and the essentially the blueprint to repenting and turning to God. And, you know, bear with me, but so I see Rahab's story as a representation, that it represents an example of how to turn away from the world and go to God. Number one, Rahab, right, once she sees the Lord and acknowledges that the Lord is God, right, she immediately understands this and has fear and reverence for the Lord. Number two, she acts in accordance, right, she shows her faith by putting herself in danger and shielding the Israelite spies that come in, right? And number three, and I want to highlight this part. At the end, she can't stay in the city with the others who are being destroyed, right? The city is being wiped out, and she, who is no longer, because she is separated from herself, from that life, from those things, through her faith, she can no longer exist in those things, right? The reason why I want to draw that similarity and that parallel with how, you know, believers must go into their new life with Christ. Well, number one, we have to acknowledge and fear the Lord and have reverence for him. Number two, we have to act in accordance, right? We can't just say things. We can't just talk the talk. We have to walk the walk, right? And then number three, we can't have those things existing within us anymore. We need to separate ourselves from the world, like how Rahab was taken out of the city. And those things need to be burned away in order for her to move forward. And so now she's a part of the body. Even though she's not an Israelite, even though she's not like a Jew, she is still able to come into and exist among the Lord's people because of these things. And so I think that in order for us to exist with the Lord, we have to do those three things as well. Now, obviously, there's some other, you know, aspects that don't quite carry over. But in its most basic and simple form, I feel this is an example of how to turn away from the world and turn to God in faith. All right, cool. Now that I've spilled off about that, does anybody have any thoughts or ideas to go off?
She may not have even seen God, but she did hear, you know, she did hear what was going on, and she didn't deny the power of God, and hearing it, and then believing it, and then fearing God, it's the beginning of repentance. It's the beginning of turning to God, becoming a Christian. It's hearing the word, believing it, and then confessing it, and then taking action.
And notice also how the Israelites don't reject her. You know, she's a foreigner, she's a Gentile, she's, you know, for all intents and purposes, just like everyone else in that city. But they allow her to come in and live among them. And her entire family. And that also goes off the idea that, you know, your actions and your action towards God can also either spread to other people in a good way or in a bad way, right? In this instance, it was good. But any other thoughts or ideas?
Might it also be an example that you can bargain, plead with God? It would have destroyed the city, but she made a bargain for her life with God.
Interesting.
In essence, it appears us asking God.
I guess you could say that.
It didn't change God's plan.
It didn't change God's plan. You're right, it didn't change God's plan. I don't know. What are some ideas on that? Maybe it's the wording, like bargaining, but
continue to request it, pleading for your life.
Yeah. And so
the one true God.
Acting through faith and submitting and having confidence that you acknowledging God's power and treating him as though he is God will in turn.
We have several other examples of pardoning with God, yeah, where we're making requests, something, or it's, yeah, for other pleads
thoughts to go off of that? Or
it's interesting. I always thought of that as like a sacrifice, just because she sacrifices her safety and comfort to hide those spies, because I'm sure during that time, you know, there's some anxiety, or just, you know, it's just not an easy thing to do, which requires, you know, sacrifices of time and you know, your time to go through that process, and also just comfort as well. But, you know, it's I think it does speak to the relationship that we have with God, that it's, you know, as God has made a sacrifice for us, you know, in this relationship we make sacrifices of our own, and sort of like a give and take. Maybe if, like, I guess you can, sometimes that can be thought of as a bargain as well. Just sort of that, you know, we give from, receive from God, but, you know, also we give our time and our talents and everything that we can give to God, you know, that he receives and, you know, approves of or disapproves of in his sight. If that makes sense.
Okay. My dad is outside and he's confused right now. He's walking the other way.
You want me to get him?
Could somebody get him, please? I'm just gonna text him. So, moving on. So, verse 36, I'll just finish the chapter. So, verse 26. At that time, Joshua pronounced this solemn oath. Cursed before the Lord is the one who undertakes to rebuild this city, Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn son, he will lay its foundations at the cost of his youngest. He will set up its gates. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout the land. All right, so, so the Lord, well, actually, no, not the Lord. So Joshua makes this pronouncement, this oath. Why do you think that he makes such a heavy oath in this moment? What do you think is the significance of this moment, and why he would, you know, go to this length in order to say, no, this shouldn't be built again? Any takes?
Maybe because, like, Jericho was kind of a representation of sin, and so he was like, no one should rebuild this city where a bunch of sin was done. Just maybe it wasn't that the city itself, the stones were evil, but, like, maybe he was giving up that.
And so because of the sin that the city represented, we shouldn't go back to that, and we shouldn't try to emulate that again. And notice that he also he committed everything into that city to destruction, right? So because of God's proclamation and because of God's rule to devote everything in that city to destruction, this is God's work that he's done, right? He's destroyed this city, and he wants it to stay that way. And so to come back and to... And so Joshua makes this proclamation in order to essentially dissuade anyone from saying, you know, I'm going to come back and I'm going to rebuild Jericho. This is something that the Lord has done. This is the Lord's work, and the Lord's work should not be undone, right? So,
that's right. I mean, this is the first city that they're taking. The promise for the rest of the cities was that they would inhabit these cities, houses that they hadn't built, vineyards that they hadn't planted. They get to enjoy that, but like with everything else that God expected, as far as that kind of first fruit type of deal being offered to him, I think I'm seeing this in the same way, that it's the first city that they're taking, really, that he's giving to them, but that they don't do that city, it's getting destroyed, kind of to the Lord there.
I think it all ties into, I began to study this, and my first thought was, why would God destroy these people? Men, women, children, donkeys. So it took me back to Deuteronomy. Okay. When you come into the land which the Lord has given, you shall not learn to follow the abomination of those nations. I'll be quick. That should not be found among you. Information thrown past through the fire, witchcraft, soothsayer. It dawned on me that God, Israel was an instrument of judgment against the people of those lands, Jericho initially. And I'm assuming that God did not want that rebuilt. It was, by the way, in 2 Kings, or 1 Kings a little later, it's another story. God didn't want the evil to be replicated. Again, we have to realize, why would God destroy these people? Was it just because they were in Israel's way? No. Because they practiced the occult. Because they were totally as one against God. And I believe that's the reason he didn't want it rebuilt also.
And it's also the reason why he didn't want Israel to intermingle with them, you know, like you said in Deuteronomy, not to intermingle with these people. And so, yeah, God brought the Israelites in not just to receive their blessing and not just to receive their inheritance, but also to be a punishment to the wicked who were inhabiting these lands, right, in their ways that were abominable in his eyes. Right? So, yeah. Anybody have any other thoughts or ideas?
Maybe I'm thinking wrong. If I remember correctly, I think there's a passage that mentions that one of the reasons why God allowed the Israelites to come into Canaan is because he was punishing the people in Canaan for all the sin that they had been doing somewhere in the New Testament, I think.
Oh, oh really?
Deuteronomy 9:4 says that.
Oh. But you said New Testament.
The New Testament.
Either way, still a good quote. Alrighty. Does anybody have anything else to add for the whole chapter before we move on to Joshua 7? Alright, so moving on to Joshua 7, we see that they receive victory, but not everything is hunky-dory. Moving on, I'll just start. Actually, Alex, could you read verses 1 through 1 through, oh, actually, 1 and 2 to me, please?
Of chapter 7?
Yeah.
But the sons of Israel acted unfaithfully in regard to the things under the ban. For Achan the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, from the tribe of Judah, took some of the things under the ban. Therefore, the anger of the Lord burned against the sons of Israel. Now Joshua sent messengers from Jericho to Ai, which is near Beth Aven, east of Bethel, and said to them, "Go up and spy out the land." So the men went up and spied out Ai. All
right. So first, we see that this guy named Achan, who's son of a lot of people, son of Camri, son of Zimri, son of the Zerah of the tribe of Judah, he took some things that he wasn't supposed to, things that were supposed to be devoted to destruction. And so this burned the Lord's anger against, what does it say in the end of the end of verse 1? Against
Israel.
Whom? Against Israel. So this one guy did something that probably not everybody knew about, right? Because later on we get context that they had to do an entire, you know, search and destroy throughout Israel. And yet all of Israel got the smoke from God because of that. So what is something that we can take from this, just from verse 1?
Sins don't only affect yourself, but it can also hurt other people.
Sins don't just affect yourselves, and they can also hurt other people. Right? That, and number two, don't take God's commandments lightly. I didn't mean that directly at you, Alex. I know you looked at me a little scared just now. But yeah, your sins don't just affect you, they affect other people, right? When we are living in sin, we sometimes feel as though, right, my sin is my own sin. You know, it doesn't spread, it doesn't affect, you know, it can possibly affect anyone else, especially if I'm keeping it secret so well. But here's the thing. It is affecting other people. It just might not be affecting other people in ways you know, right, or ways that you're willing to acknowledge. And sometimes it's more overt, sometimes it's more subtle. But either way, when you are living in sin and continuing in sin and then try to, you know, come back and be with the rest of the people, in a way, you are being a, let's say, a spiritual detractor. You are detracting from the blessings of others by continuing to exist in sin, right? And so right here, and because, you know, God is angry, and so right here we see that the Lord is angry with all of Israel, not just one person, even though he was the one that did it. Anyways, does anyone have anything to say before I move on?
This is a sermon. So, for those who don't know, I teach fourth grade, so we go over this many times, and oftentimes in, like, the lunchroom, for example, the whole fourth grade's in there, sometimes kindergarten's in there. Sometimes we'll come back from lunch, and the aides will be like, they didn't put away their garbage, they were yelling, they were screaming, like, a couple of kids, whatever. So, a couple kids ruin the whole lunch, then they can't sit by their friends anymore, and it's kind of a repeated thing. So, it's one of these things, you know, one sour apple ruins the whole lunch.
Yep.
So, even though it's a one person or a couple people, you know, every person you're in contact with, you sour those people too.
We're treated as a unit. We're treated just like Lee said. We're treated as one body. So, Lee.
There was a fear. There was a danger. He hid the accursed things. He hid some occult stuff. It just wasn't normal for us. There was a fear that this demonic spirit might spread into Israel. Committed a trespass regarding the accursed things. He brought some of that demonic into the camp. And I believe that's why God was really
upset.
Yes.
And so I actually want to bring back that point as we go later on. But yeah, it's not like he just took a donkey or, like, you know, a piece of gold that was hit sitting on the ground. You know, this is something that's more, even though that would still be wrong and that would still incite the Lord's anger, it's not just something so simple as that.